The emergency alert system in this province continues to rest in the hands of incompetence. Yesterday, we were in the GTA, treated to frequent interruptions in programming on radio and TV, while our cell phones were screaming alerts like partying teenagers on Instagram. And what was the emergency? A boy had been taken by someone who wasn't authorized to have him in Thunder Bay. As we were told the suspect was in a car, it would be at least 12 hours of hard driving before she was within the broadcast signal of the GTA media and cell phone holders who were constantly told to be on alert. My criticism here is not about the plight of the boy or the idea of the emergency system, but no one, not a single one of us, could be of any help to a missing boy in Thunder Bay. The media collectively are anxious to help when a true emergency occurs. Anything I might be doing on the show when the alert comes in is not close to being as important as a missing child. But we want to have confidence that the people giving us the alert know what they're doing and that the alerts are relevant to our listeners. With the new element of the alert system being a message on everyone's cell phone, relevance is of increased concern. Yesterday, we were all made aware that the people running the system either don't know that Thunder Bay is a terrifically long way from the GTA, or they have slapped together a shotgun approach that just takes over everyone's radio, TV, and phone, regardless of the usefulness of the message. The problem with that approach is that it teaches too many of us to be irritated with the system rather than responsive to it. According to Google, it's easy to set a phone to ignore the alerts. Too many irritating and useless messages will compel many people to do so. Granted, it was better yesterday than the time back in March of 2016 when the alert system told any of us with information to call September 1st, 2001. Do you remember that? The text-to-voice system read 911 as a date rather than the emergency phone number.
Ontario Amber Alert Police. Toronto Police Service child. 3-month-old baby boy. Short dark hair. Ab doctor. Male white. 20 to 25 years old. Short blonde hair. 5 foot 11 inches. Medium built vehicle. 10 color 4-door 1997 Toyota Camry, Ontario plate BWRC January 6, 2001 location last observed, northbound Highway 27 at Albion Road if observed call September 1, 2001.
Can you call September 1, 2001 collect? A government entity that demands control of our information systems has a duty to do much better than the easily mockable job they've done right from the beginning. On the panel today, Randy Rahamim, principal at Navigator, with focus on management, design, and execution of public affairs. Sandy Annunziata, Niagara Regional Councillor, representing the town of Fort Erie, chair of the Niagara Peninsula Conservation Authority. And Jennifer Innes, Regional Councillor, Ward 3 and 4, town of Caledon within the region of Peel.
Call Randy. September 1st, 2001.
Okay, you were rolling your eyes at me there, Randy, so go ahead.
Well, of course, Jerry, you've taken the most extreme opinion on this issue. I actually wasn't bothered at all by the emergency alerts yesterday because they don't come up on my phone. So if we actually are in a real emergency, I'm going to be the last to know. I'll be like, where did all the people go? They must be in the bunker somewhere. I didn't get the notice. So I hope that they fix that. My experience with this is only qualitative. I was recently in Florida a few weeks ago, and I kept getting alerts on my phone twice while I was there. One was an Amber Alert, and the other was there was a tornado warning, like, in my immediate vicinity. And I found them very helpful. Like, we actually did have to go and hide out for a couple of hours because of the tornado warning. So I think it's good that we're finally using it here in Ontario. I agree that, you know, something that's 14 hours away by car is not necessarily something that we can help with in the GTA. But maybe it's a province-wide thing. Like, maybe they can't distinguish jurisdictions.
Of course they could. Because where were you when you got these tornado warnings?
I was in the immediate vicinity, but...
No. Where were you?
Florida.
Okay. So they knew that you, even though you have a cell phone from Toronto... were in the immediate vicinity.
But I don't know if that was a statewide thing, like if you were in the state.
But they knew your phone was there.
Yes.
What I'm saying is technologically, I don't see this being a difficulty. But the problem is it's being run by, ultimately, apparatchiks from the government. And Sandy, since you're part of the government, how do you respond to that?
Not that government.
I think there's merit to what you're saying, Jerry, because I've been in situations before where these emergency broadcasts, they actually inconvenience me, they tune me out, they actually have the effect of marginalizing the emergency nature of the message. And I'll use a quick example. I remember I was in a hotel room and the alarm kept on going off all night long. And it became an annoyance at that point. And you just kind of tend to ignore it and turn it off. So I do see what you're saying, but you know, if you're one of those family members that's actually you know, involved in a situation like this, you want the message as widespread and as out there as possible, and you want it to be annoying because you want to get people's attention. But the same point is, you don't want it, you know, people to kind of ignore it at that point.
All right, but if a kid goes missing here in Toronto, that's happened a couple of times recently, and we've done the alerts and we've done everything we could as a radio station to make sure people know about it, that they're aware we're trying to find this kid, and the kid walked out of a building in Toronto. Has that kid, over the last 6-7 hours, walked to Thunder Bay? I don't think so. So doing everything you can doesn't mean being ridiculous.
I know,
about
but you know, everyone seems to think that Toronto is the center of the universe anyway. So if you're going to put the measure, the message out there, get it out in the GTA as well. I mean, you know, you're talking about economies of scale.
No, here's
critical
the problem.
Mass. You got a whole bunch of Toronto people getting this message. Maybe they're making phone calls. Maybe they're on social media. I mean, it's just that cascading effect, you hope, anyways.
You know what the worst thing is? When you defend incompetence by saying they care. Because then, yesterday, did you watch social media? See the number of people who were really ticked about this? And what's going to happen is they're going to figure out how to go on their phone and shut off the emergency system. And that's the last thing we want to have happen. We want people to get engaged when they can help. Jennifer, do you have 10 seconds on this?
I think they've learned their lesson from this, I'm hoping, and heard the backlash, and will improve the system to make it actually work and be functional.
On the panel today, it's Randy, Sandy, and Jenny from the farm. And you know, Jennifer, that we say that with love.
I know.
Hey,
so Jenny from the loving farm.
So good story. I was in a meeting yesterday, and a couple of the gentlemen that I was meeting with says, yeah, I listen to you all the time on the radio, Sandy. Sandy, Randy, and Jenny from the farm.
So it's working. We need someone to sing it.
Apparently, it's catching on.
It's catching on. Yeah. Do you remember our little jingle with Chris Stockwell?
Tuesday morning, all-star. Yeah.
All-star panel, right?
All-star panel.
We need Jen to record a jingle for us.
Oh, no, you don't.
All right.
The all-star panel.
That's it.
Good quick work there, Nick. I miss Chris. Now, there's a bunch of controversy around the United States finally doing what they said they were going to do since 1995 and putting an American embassy in Jerusalem. Why would they do that? What's the capital of Israel, Randy?
Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's a strange place to put an embassy, isn't it? The capital of a country?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't understand why this is even controversial, actually.
I think because it's become a proxy issue for whether or not you support Israel, whether or not your views on Middle East peace and the future of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem as a proxy. And what's actually happening here most recently with Trump's decision to actually move the embassy to Jerusalem, even though it was actually voted on in 1995, is that I think mainstream media, a lot of the mainstream media, are conflating the issue of support for the move to Jerusalem with support for Trump. And they're two completely different issues.
Right.
For many of us who watch CNN, you'll start to see this narrative unfolding on CNN over the past few days. And it's become a proxy issue. If you support the move, then you support Trump. And I think that's a very, very and if you support the move, then you must not support Palestinians. I think that's a very, very dangerous setup for the issue. I think that, you know, I think it's a very important thing for many Israelis, for the establishment and the institutions in Israel. But at the same time, for the average Israeli, they just want to live in peace. They want to have a happy day-to-day life.
And you think the average Palestinian is the same?
I think the average Palestinian...
The average human?
100%. And if you actually go and visit Jerusalem, you'll see that, especially in the old city, in the old part of Jerusalem, that you've got the Muslim quarter and you've got the Armenian quarter and you've got the Christian quarter, the Jewish quarter. Everybody's sort of very close together and peaceful. Now, the odd thing, the odd flare up every once in a while. But you'd be surprised how neighbors live together in Jerusalem. This is not a big issue for the average person.
I think Randy is right, Sandy, that people are making this more of a commentary on Donald Trump. But it was actually the policy of the United States since 1995. Who was president then?
That's a great point. Right? And it's unbelievable.
No.
Bill Clinton.
You have a president that follows through with exactly what he said he was going to do. And, you know, the heads of the left just must be exploding because they have no way to spin this in a negative way other than to suggest that this is wrongheaded approach. You know, this is not good for Middle Eastern peace talks. And they can give you all these, you know, straw man arguments, but they can't tell you why. Why this is a good thing? Why this is a bad thing? It's to Randy's point.
We hate Trump.
It's an indirect attack on Donald Trump for doing exactly what he said he was going to do.
Vivian Bercovici has a great column on this in the National Post today, and among her other qualifications as a law professor, etc., she's a former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and her position here is, Jennifer, placing an embassy in Jerusalem is not a barrier to negotiating peace. It just seems to make sense to put one in a capital city.
So I'm not as well versed on this topic. So I was actually having a conversation with Randy beforehand about this.
Okay.
And that was my sort of take on it. I don't understand why, if it's the capital, why don't you have the embassy in the capital? And I understand it's you know, everybody's trying to keep peace, but there is peace there, and this was promised years ago, and this was 50 years ago that it became Israel. So why?
Well, look, no, Israel's been around since like the Roman times.
Well, I'm talking about with the state of
the state. Cut her some slack.
Give me a little bit, a little bit. So I don't understand why, you know, and I think to Sandy's point. This is just a bashing of Trump. This was approved by the government in 1995.
You know, one of the things I was reading is some people said, well, in fact, it's controversial as to whether or not Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Israel says it is, and that's it. Do we need the United Nations to come along one day, Randy, and tell us that our capital is Winnipeg?
No, and the United Nations of all international bodies, I mean, let's face it, they're not exactly the barometers of world peace. I mean, if you look at the composition of the UN Security Council, you'll see not the most stellar group of world leaders and supporters of peace. So whether the UN agrees with it or not, this is it's actually the United States' decision as to where they put their embassy. They had previously decided to put it in Tel Aviv. In 1995, under Bill Clinton, they decided to move it to Jerusalem. And now President Trump is executing on what was promised back in 1995.
All right. I don't want to just assume this is more important to you because you're Jewish and the rest of us aren't. But still, I'm going to ask you this next question as well. Does it matter to you whether or not Canada puts an embassy in Jerusalem, or keeping it in Tel Aviv just means at least we have an embassy in Israel?
What matters to me is that Canada tries and thin this and skate the thin line in between. And that actually is more offensive to me than taking a hard position. Canada's come out and said that it's going to keep its embassy in Tel Aviv. But if you look at the comments of Marc-André Blanchard, our ambassador to the UN, he basically gave some middle of the road statement as to whether or not they support the move or don't support the move that made absolutely no sense. I think that's actually unfair. I think that and this comes back to the issue being a proxy for conservatives and liberals and a broader political issue. But if you look at the issue on the face of the issue, the embassy should probably be in Jerusalem.
Yeah, and I think people are very tired of politicians that lack conviction, and they'd rather utter these talking points and the same old political rhetoric that this issue has garnered for probably the last, you know, two decades. Enough with the talking points and give me some conviction. At the very least, I can say Donald Trump, like him or hate him, he stuck to his word and he's a politician with conviction.
Yeah, and previous presidents said that they were going to put one in Jerusalem and didn't. News Talk 1010's 7th annual In-Depth and Interactive is back June 12th at the Liberty Grand, and we've saved a pair of front row tickets just for you. And so if you screwed up and didn't buy tickets, you've got a chance to win them. Enter online at newstalk1010.com for your chance to win. Thanks to our sponsor, Aaron Waxman and Associates. On the panel today, Jennifer Innes is here, Regional Councillor, Ward 3 and 4, Town of Caledon in the Region of Peel. Sandy Annunziata, Niagara Regional Councillor, representing the Town of Fort Erie. He's the chair of the Niagara Peninsula Conservation Authority. And Randy Rahamim is a principal at Navigator with a focus on management, design, and execution of public affairs. Tesla's autopilot mode was on during a crash in Utah. This happened at just under 100 kilometers per hour when the car slammed into the back of a fire truck, which was stopped at a red light. This isn't a highway accident. It's 97 kilometers an hour approaching a red light and slamming into the back of a fire truck. The semi-autonomous autopilot mode was engaged, and the woman may have been looking at her phone. What I find most compelling about this is co-founder of Tesla, and the guy pushing this self-driving car concept is Elon Musk. And he said, quote, "It was super messed up that the incident was garnering public attention. While thousands of accidents involving traditional automobiles get almost no coverage." Has he missed the point, Sandy?
I think so, but I love Elon Musk's optimism and the way that he's twisted a very bad story into a good story. Because what was his point? He goes, yeah, but at 96 kilometers an hour, and he just broke his foot. That's unbelievable.
She just broke her foot. That's all that happened.
Yeah. I guess you got to turn a bad situation, especially in this case, because it's getting a lot of negative press. And this is supposed to be the next trend in automotive whatever. And it's hitting some snags with people getting in accidents and actually deaths. There's been quite a few deaths, so no way to turn this this into a good story.
I don't know that we can say there were quite a few deaths. Okay, Randy, go ahead.
Come on, I actually completely disagree. I completely agree with Elon Musk. I think that it is a little bit ridiculous that we're covering this issue in the same way. Like, think about how many car accidents there are. If you look at what it specifically says about this self-driving technology, you're not supposed to be looking at your phone when you're driving. It specifically says you can get into a car accident. You have to be aware. You can't be a distracted driver.
You
can,
you know what?
Use it, but you have to be like, it's not foolproof yet. And
okay.
So the fact that she openly admits that she was looking at her phone when she got into a car accident,
that's,
I think,
the
is
whole
ridiculous.
Idea, though.
No, it's not yet.
I'm going to say something positive. I'm going to say something positive about Randy and Navigator here. When you get yourself in a mess like Tesla's in at the moment, get Randy Fine Print Rahamim to come in. And
come on. It's not fine print. It's not like this car is autonomous and just drives you around right now. It's technology that's being tested, and it's specifically tells you, do not just like use it and like not pay attention and sit as a passenger in the car. She said, "I was on my phone when the car hit a hit." She didn't notice she was going to hit.
Elon Musk pushes the concept of the self-driving car that won't slam at almost 100 kilometers an hour into the back of a fire truck. For God's sake,
yeah.
It's not a kitten; it's really huge.
She was on her phone.
Well, and let's also look at the ratio. I mean, you can talk about the fact that, oh, wow, there's, you know, hundreds and thousands of other car accidents. Well, how many autonomous cars are there on the road compared to how many regular vehicles there are on a road?
Well, yes.
So there's a big difference there.
And
97 kilometers an hour into the back of a fire truck that I think was stopped?
I'm just so confused over the whole concept of self-driving.
Agreed.
The reason you have a self-driving car is because you may be a distracted driver because you want to do maybe something else because you have the technology for self-driving cars. That's
so
the whole idea.
Does this driver get a fine for distracted driving?
Well, probably. But you know what? There should be a fine to Tesla as well.
And Tesla should get a fine as well for that. Or maybe she'll end up suing them. Do they have to sign some sort of agreement?
The auto company markets the system as the future of driving, but warns drivers to remain alert while using the autopilot and not to rely on it to entirely avoid accidents. And police reiterated that warning. They tell people, you can't just rely on it. It's part of the feature of the car, but it's like when you go into, what's it called? Cruise control.
Yeah.
Do you just stop paying attention to the driving when you're in cruise control on the highway?
No,
you still know that you might need to hit your brake.
Cigarettes
to slow
cause
down.
Cancer.
Not the same thing, Randy.
There's a disclaimer on everything.
The cruise control thing is not even a good example.
Also, who uses cruise control?
I do.
Oh, I do.
Wow,
yeah.
Really? I've never used it once.
I use it when I go on long distance,
yes,
because otherwise my right knee will seize up on me. I need to be able to move it around a little bit. A
lot of long stretches of road in Caledon.
Well, you know what? I actually don't really use it in Caledon. I use it for long distance. If I'm going to Ottawa to visit my best friend, as an example, I absolutely put on. There's too many.
Do all cars still come with cruise control?
Absolutely.
I feel like that's an old school feature.
What do you got, a 1967 Studebaker? What do you?
I got the TTC, okay?
Along with rack and pin. Opinion steering. I don't even know
the
what
opinions and recommendations expressed on vehicles is strictly that of the commentator or commentators.
Like the Flintstones.
Yeah, four-barrel carburetor. Okay, Ontario's disdain for carbon taxes transcends party lines. This is a report from the Toronto Sun. It's interesting that even Liberal and NDP supporters think that a carbon tax is nothing more than just a cash grab. And what I find interesting about this, Randy, is it doesn't mean that people don't think that there's some sort of issue that we should be looking at in terms of our use of carbon fuels and what's happening with the planet. They just don't think carbon taxes are a solution and are just a way for the government to take money out of our pocket.
I think it's brilliant that we needed a poll to tell us that the vast majority of people don't like a new tax. I think if you ask anybody, do any polling on a tax, you're going to see similar results, whether it's a carbon tax or a childcare tax or any other tax that we're going to look at, you're going to see the same results. So it doesn't surprise me at all. And this is a whole new concept for people that you're putting a price on carbon and that this is a commodity that we're going to tax. So I think it's going to take some time for people to change their ways. It is a social agenda, right? Like if you really...
Randy.
Jerry, are we just going to fight about this?
If you were reading up, you'd know that most countries have found out that it actually doesn't work and doesn't have any impact. And I think the majority of Ontarians are up to speed on it. That's why they're voting the way they do.
Yeah, I'm sure they're fully well-versed in issues around carbon pricing and carbon taxes. And that's why they're opposed to this, not because it's just another tax.
I think it's interesting that the poll actually points out that millennials are the more likely generation to actually approve of this incentive than any other generation.
Yeah, because their parents are paying the taxes.
Well, young people in general are more open-minded when it comes to environmental policy. I think that's not new either.
Yeah, but the rollout has been absolutely horrible because give me the metrics. Let me see how this is going to impact, number one, the environment. It's going to reduce the carbon footprint. Let me know that what you're doing is actually accomplishing something. And so far, no one has been able to do that. There's going to be very little impact. And at the end of the day, what you're trying to do is create, to your point, this social agenda. But the explanation just doesn't resonate with people.
Well, hang on.
Don't you think it'd be better to give incentives? For example, the region of Peel, when we do our new contracts for our waste collection, we said you have to use compressed natural gas because we want to reduce our carbon footprint. So why wouldn't the government mm-hmm. be giving incentives to businesses and municipalities to run programs like that actually prove to reduce the carbon footprint instead of doing a carbon tax like this?
But they already do. So if you look at some of the most largest polluters in the industrial sector, they've already installed some mm-hmm. of that best practice technology to reduce those emissions, to reduce that carbon footprint. Just to unilaterally impose it on every man, woman, and child to suggest that this is going to be good for the environment, but not tell me how it's going to be good for the environment, not tell me how much it's going to reduce my carbon footprint. That's why people are so outraged over this.
On the panel, it's the usual Tuesday gathering of Randy, Sandy, and Jenny from the farm. Needle exchanges coming to two Canadian prisons. The arguments being made here are that, hey, they're using needles and doing drugs in prison anyway, so we might as well facilitate it, which is a funny way to run a prison, in my view. And in one of the articles I read about this morning, there was actually an argument made, Jennifer, that somehow we're violating the constitutional rights of prisoners if we don't do this. When did prisoners get the constitutional right to sharp, pointy objects?
Shocking. I honestly can't believe this. When I look at this, the safety of the workers that work there and the other inmates. And B, I thought there was a zero tolerance policy. Why are you giving them the opportunity? If you know that there is a drug problem in the prison, get it out. Do something to eradicate it because they're not supposed to have access to drugs inside the prison system.
Well, this whole idea of they're going to do it anyway, so let's facilitate it. Well, why are they in prison? Because they broke the law. But hey, Sandy, they're going to do it anyway. Why are we locking them up?
Such a ridiculous premise. You're supposed to uphold the law, and the reason that you're in a correctional facility is because you broke the law. Now what we're doing is we're pandering and we're accommodating and we're encouraging more law breaking once you get within those prison walls. It's absolutely unbelievable. I understand the harm reduction premise, but I just don't agree with it.
But that's
especially,
for society in
especially
general.
Especially in correctional facilities. I'm sorry. This doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah, correctional and facilitation don't go together.
Right. And what about the safety of the guards? I mean, you're now handing inmates needles that they can use in theory, to attack the guards. So I think this is absolutely
crazy.
And one another. I don't know why. I mean, someone needs to explain the rationale behind this. It can't just be harm reduction. I mean, the fact that they're allowed illegal drugs in prison makes it no longer illegal. And, you know, the guards raise very good questions themselves, saying, so wait a second, we thought we were supposed to crack down on illegal drug use. Does that mean that we're just supposed to turn a blind eye now? Like,
well, somebody just wrote in, drugs get into the system because of unscrupulous guards. That may well be true, but then crack down on that. Figure it out. Fire some guards. I'm not saying it's easy.
Put the resources in the right place. Put the resources behind rehab for some of these folks. Put the resources behind healthcare for these folks. Getting the right guards and retraining guards. But don't put the resources behind making illegal drug use legal in jails.
I've never seen such a more defeatist commentary. They're going to get drugs anyway, so we might as well accommodate them in that prison setting. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And can't we then be liable? Can't the government of Canada then be liable for drug addiction of some of these inmates? Can't you then make a case later on once, you know, that in fact we're now letting loose a whole bunch of, once they actually complete their term in jail, once they complete their sentence, they go out on the streets as drug addicts, and we essentially enabled that.
Not to mention, they're wasting their days away in a euphoric state. When they're supposed to be sitting in there thinking about what they've done and making amends and trying
suffering
to facilitate themselves, basically.
All right. Stephen Harper was being interviewed in the United States, and he said that he could still easily be the conservative leader. He's not saying he could easily still be prime minister. They lost the election. He gets that. But he said, I essentially formed that party, and I'm paraphrasing, but he's saying, I could have set up a bunch of rules had I wanted nothing but power to keep myself in power inside the party. I didn't do that because I knew that the party needed to survive me. It wasn't about me. So, Randy, you're the more liberal member of the gathering here. So how do you react to that?
Well, what I find most interesting is that Stephen Harper is really coming out of his shell. I mean, he always seemed to me the most guarded of our leaders, you know, very, very conservative, very quiet, didn't actually, you know, talk much or make many public appearances after he was prime minister. So we haven't seen much of Stephen Harper, but in the last few months, he's, you know, we see a huge number of opinion editorials in the papers on coming from Stephen Harper. He's taken a real stance on a number of international issues. And now he's coming out talking to classes about about his time in power. I think it's great that he's speaking out. I do think it's quite pompous to say that you would still be the leader of the party and that the party, and not recognizing the party, is something more than just you.
No, what I understood him to say was it's not necessarily that he'd be still so wildly popular. He could have put in place a set of rules that would have made it hard to get rid of him had he been, you know, had the kingmaker mentality.
Which I could have been more of a dictator, but I'm not. Like, I don't know what you're trying to say there.
I think factually he's not incorrect. He could have, you know, it's easy for any leader and a party to work together to change the rules to make things happen the way they would like it to happen. That's not uncommon. That's not like it doesn't happen. And I think that's all he's saying is that, you know, there's ways to manipulate systems to make things work to your advantage when you're in those positions.
I think Stephen Harper's had a bit of an epiphany. And for the longest time, he was the politician that kind of shied away, that wasn't as outspoken as he has appeared to be over the last probably few months. He's putting, his name to ads in the New York Post. He's being more provocative in his commentary on public affairs. He's saying things that would normally really, you know, irk the electorate if he was still a politician. Good for him. He's saying things that probably, the shackles have been lifted with respect to, his political correctness in the past.
All right. One more thing. NDP surge in the polls, the National Post column reads, is no guarantee that the NDP is a true contender in the Ontario election. You guys watch this stuff pretty carefully. Do you think that the polls we've seen over the last little while show that it's a done deal? It's at least a minority conservative government?
Well, I never say it's a done deal. There's still lots of work to do from the conservative point aside, from the NDP's point aside. I mean, I just saw Kathleen Wynne in an announcement this morning, and she looks tired and haggard and just defeated. When you've officially assumed third-party status, I think the writing is on the wall for the Liberals. But with respect to the NDP, they're doing well, but I think even the NDP has a ceiling. And to the article's point, unless you start cannibalizing conservative votes, and let's face it, that's a leap of faith, because now you have to jump the political spectrum from conservative all the way to the left of the NDP, that's a very difficult challenge.
Very difficult challenge to make. And I, as somebody, you know, who sits on that right, it would be very difficult for me to ever go that far left. But that also makes me nervous because there could be a government formed between the NDP and the Liberals. And I think that people and residents need to pay attention, because what's worse than a Liberal government? Probably one partnered with the NDP, because you're going to get more of the same of what you've had for the last 14 years.
Yeah, I do think, though, that, you know, this is a choice. I think voters are actually looking at what's the least, like, nobody's in love with, I think, any of the candidates. Some people are, but I think people are trying to say, who's the least offensive to me? And in that, with that question, it might be Andrea Horvath.